This week I'm joined by James Riley, who is a Fellow of English Literature at Girton College, Cambridge. He focuses on modern and contemporary literature, popular film, and the culture of the 60s. In this episode, we discuss his latest publication, The Bad Trip, Dark Omens, New Worlds, and the End of the 60s, alongside discussions on counterculture, evil, post-structuralism, activism, and control. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my patrons and paid subscribers for making all of this possible, and if you'd like to support Omedics or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. James Riley, thanks for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
How are you?
I'm good. Yourself?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
That's okay. So we're going to be talking about your new book, The Bad Trip, Dark Omens, New Worlds, and the End of the 60s, which is sort of a... Well, it's quite a strange book. It's an overview of what was going on in the 60s, which... For many people who've read these kind of books, that's going to sound cheap, but what James is doing here is assessing the 60s and early 70s through a lens which is honing in on the inherent darkness which was within the culture at the time. So before we jump in with the Hermetics question, just tell us a little bit about yourself, James, and why it was you came to write this book.
Well, thank you very much again for having me, and hello to everyone who's listening. My name's James. I am a writer and academic. I currently work at the University of Cambridge. I'm a Fellow of English at Girton College in Cambridge, and I specialise in the modern and contemporary periods, broadly the 20th and 21st century. So I teach across that field, but I also do research in that area. I've got a big interest in the beat writers, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, those kind of people. Always very much been interested in the 1960s. I've worked on the material quite extensively. I did a big long editorial project with the novelist and filmmaker Peter Whitehead. I used to run his archive for a number of years. So all this material has also been there within my sort of professional and personal life, and just a point of interest. And I really did want to sort of pull a lot of these parallel strands together. I wanted to look at their intersections. I've been long fascinated with the 1960s, but as you say, some of the elements that you might want to call the dark side. This goes back to childhood and early teenage years. I grew up listening to sounds of the 60s, grew up listening to my father's record collection, grew up listening to Britpop, bands like Cooler Shaker and all those kind of people. But I was also really interested in that every time you actually looked into 1960s culture, whether that be film or television, there was a lot of the sort of brightness and the bright psychedelic colours and a lot of the kind of day glow optimism that you might expect. But you didn't really have to look very far to see some of these slightly stranger, slightly darker elements. And what really sort of fascinated me is that they often starkly juxtaposed each other. If you look at reruns of Top of the Pops from the mid to late 60s, you'd see kind of saccharine pop and then immediately followed by The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, a guy with his head on fire saying that he was the god of hellfire, dancing around on a sort of mainstream tea time music show. And when you look at all those sort of cult TV like The Avengers and The Prisoner and Adam Adamant and Department S, they play into that kind of James Bond, the sort of spy-y, jet-setting, aspirant demographic. But there's also elements of the surreal. There's elements of sort of interstates, quite difficult and extreme psychic territories that are playing out in a lot of that material, which was there in the general culture. This is not sort of underground culture of the 1960s. That's part of its popular culture and its general fabric. So the sort of proximity of those slightly stranger, slightly darker elements, the sort of other side of the mirror aspect of the 1960s and it being so close to the surface, always really intrigued me. And also you've got this range of events that seem to accumulate towards the end of the decade, the Manson murders, the Rolling Stones concert in Altamont, the way that they seem to be so opposed to Woodstock. this is the kind of cultural history that I really wanted to investigate, and I really wanted to sort of tell that story. It's a story that's been told before from different perspectives, but I wanted to pull a variety of different things together, really explore those seemingly quite jarring juxtapositions, tell a few stories that perhaps hadn't been told before, and put things together to create something of an uncanny history, seeing something which is very familiar, like the 1960s, but rendering it in hopefully an unfamiliar new light.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a lot of these things I think we'll touch on, but I begin here with the emetics question.
Yeah.
You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Well, I'd pick Sigmund Freud for start off.
Okay.
And then I would pick Gilles Deleuze as my second dinner party guest. And then I'd pick John C. Lilly, John Cunningham Lilly. Freud and Deleuze, I'd just be extremely interested to see the extent to which they do argue. Just the extent to which there are as many fireworks as their works would suggest. Could they possibly find some kind of common ground in their conversations? Would they even be able to get a word in between each other? And John C. Lilly, I think, will work as an interesting kind of third in that triumvirate. I'd like to see him try to convince Deleuze and Freud to get in the flotation tank, which obviously he would have with him in the room because he'd be trying to peddle that experience. Because I think Freud and Deleuze probably needed a little bit of time in a flotation tank to think through and to put some of their ideas in practice. So I think it would probably be a noisy meeting between the three of them, but it would be extremely interesting, I think, to see their work sort of begin to overlap and take the opportunity to see what might be the point of intersection and entanglement that emerges between them.
It's interesting when you mentioned the Deleuze in a flotation tank. I was talking to Joshua Ramey the other day, who wrote The Hermetic Deleuze, and apparently there's these sort of five essays that Deleuze wrote when he was younger, which he sort of, you know, he had this thing where he said, like, nothing before this date can be published. But these essays still exist, and in them he's talking about occultists and like occult practice. So I think he'd probably fairly open to
absolutely. And I'd like to see, you know, some of those metaphors from capitalism, schizophrenia, and a thousand plateaus. See if they actually, you know, the sort of body without organs, and see if they actually he's actually thinking through some kind of existential position rather than working through a kind of intellectual maneuver. That would be very interesting, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Freud would make of him, though, like, in terms of, I mean, I don't, even though it's called Anti-Oedipus, still think he's, you know, him and Guattari still retain, you know, they still mention keeping some territory, and I think they understand the importance of these things.
Absolutely.
So I do wonder what Freud, I think Freud would probably just push schizoanalysis to the side, and I think he was probably a bit too much of a serious chap. I mean, when Jung mentioned all the occult stuff to Freud, I think he just threw it to the side, so I can't imagine what he'd make of schizoanalysis.
Well, I can't, like, that's why I want to put them in a room together. I'd like to get all the frustrations out, do a few icebreakers, because of course I think the work that we're left with when we're able to pour over it and to think about all the do a kind of exegetical analysis and think through all the different allusions and references, there's all kinds of overlaps, and you see all the sort of intersections between these very sort of resonant and important works. Whether or not they can get past the personalities, I don't know. Are they going to actually get past the personalities? I don't know. And I suppose I'd be curious to see in that thinking exercise whether or not they can actually stand to listen to each other.
And John, was it John C. Lilly? I don't know too much about him. So what was he like as a person?
John C. Lilly was one of these figures who becomes associated with the counterculture as the 1960s move into the 1970s. And he's somebody who comes from a very academic and experimental background. He has links to what you might broadly call the sort of military-industrial complex in America. And he becomes very interested in forms of sensory deprivation, flotation tanks, communications with dolphins, animal communications, and so on and so forth. And his work comes out of lots of government-funded research into alleged cases of mind control and brainwashing, which is a sort of military anxiety that comes out of the Korean War. It also intersects with research into space travel and what might be the effects of long-term sensory deprivation and a lack of stimulus within those kind of contexts. And there's a variety of other researchers who are doing similar kind of work, lots of experiments taking place at McGill University with so-called black rooms. And John T. Lilly initially starts out as part of this, but he then moves in a slightly different, I suppose, slightly more spiritualized, if not mystical, position, where he begins to experiment with placing himself in heavily salinated water, where he sort of floats unencumbered of any kind of sensory stimulus. And the predominant hypothesis would that you would essentially switch off in the absence of any kind of external stimulus. But he then finds that the mind starts to essentially kind of self-generate, produce lots of information, and produce lots of stimulus in the absence of any kind of external information moving in. And he comes to regard this as sort of profoundly important experiences and an altered state. And he gradually begins to see it as a way of, if you like, contacting various disincarnate entities, moving through different sort of historical and genetic identities. And his work veers between these polarities of a very kind of experimental and procedural scientific approach to this subject, and almost a kind of Learian discourse of thinking through the sensory and the psychological potentials and significance of what he's experiencing in these sense deprived states.
Mm-hmm. I imagine, well, obviously altered states is going to come back up. But the book, The Bad Trip, it's sort of, when I was reading it, I got the sense fairly early on that you're trying to make the case within this that the devil, or sort of a satanic force or some sort of dark force, quite literally possessed the 60s. Now, where do you think this came from? I mean, if you agree with me, that is.
Well, I think that you could make that case if you look back to the sort of various cultural shifts within the landscape of the 1960s. I think certainly that would be a very good summary, if you like, or a very good way of interpreting the appearance of films like Rosemary's Baby, the Roman Polanski film, which has a certain place within this matrix of intersections and overlaps between events and you know, films and cultural products, in the way that, say, Roman Polanski then very unfortunately and very terribly and very tragically for him begins to be entangled within the kind of Manson story. So you could look at the popular culture and the film and the cinema and some of the literature of the 1960s and say, yes, at some point in the mid to the later point of the decade, the devil does seem to loom large. But of course, you've also got artists and thinkers and writers like filmmaker Kenneth Anger, who's deeply influenced by Aleister Crowley. You've got a variety of sort of splinter and micro-religions. You might disparagingly want to call them cults, like the Process Church of the Final Judgment, and of course the Church of Satan itself, which is developed and by Anton LaVey, which puts within the public discourse and puts within the popular culture a much greater currency linked to this figure of Satan and figure of the devil. And I think that in one sense, that kind of makes sense, in the sense that there was a decline in respect for, adherence to, attendance in relation to quote-unquote conventional religion. A kind of Judeo-Christian worldview started to wane for a variety of reasons in that period. But I think the more kind of significant figure here, in the sense of drawing together lots of different spheres and individuals and areas of the culture, would be a figure, not so much the devil per se, not so much Satan, but also a figure like Lucifer, this idea of this rebellious former angel figure. Certainly the figure of Lucifer is someone who meant a lot to Kenneth Anger. It's a sort of word and a figure that permeates through different avenues, if you like, in the cultural landscape. The Rolling Stones play with this figure quite a lot, and it's it's not so much a kind of movement to the dark side in the sense of a complete inversion. It's more a sense of embracing a certain kind of rebellious spirit. That certainly seemed to be what someone like Anger was trying to promote in his celebration of this figure, and certainly what people who found themselves gravitated towards Kenneth Anger seemed to get from that. As to why there was such a big take-up in these ideas, as to why there were so many kind of parallel spheres of interest, so many different artists and writers thinking about this at the time, why in general these diabolical figures and these representations of the devil took on such prominence within the decade, I think it does come back to this idea that there's something of a demographic shift. I think there's something of a paradigm shift within the culture, where you have a young and educated, a curious, disillusioned and frustrated generation moving away from the standards and the orthodoxies and the conventions and the language and the images of their parental generation. The writer Joseph Burke, in a book called Counterculture, written in 1969, he referred to, when he was trying to bring all these different senses of a kind of cultural shift together, he talks about it as a movement away from the parental stem, moving away from parental pressure, parental expectation, the whole idea of the nuclear family and what that represents, the whole idea of a certain kind of Protestant work ethic, the whole idea of certain kinds of expectations in terms of one's life trajectory. Now you can see this in terms of just moving away, if you like, from a 9-to-5 existence, attempting to move into some kind of social and economic autonomy. But I think the figure of the devil, and I think the associated figures like Lucifer, also highlight and sort of shed light onto the fact that that similar kind of movement was also taking place on a religious and a spiritual level, that there was a sort of dissatisfaction with the standard, conventional, in some ways hypocritical nature of conventional Judeo-Christian religion at that time.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that then this rebellion against the parental stem sort of backfires for everyone in this generation, in this era?
I don't think it backfires necessarily. I think it's easy to look at the 1960s as a kind of failed project. This is one of many narratives that's often said and what used to describe the 1960s, that you get this fabulous kind of arc of kind of optimism and creativity and progressive politics and movements forward, but it seems to wither at the end of the decade, and I think that's why there's so much emphasis placed on events like Altamont and the Manson murders, because they seem to hold up a very dark mirror to everything that was hoped for and planned and projected and plotted out before that, as if these are these kind of great disasters which ended this project. I mean, obviously they were terrible events, but I don't think they were sort of enough to really kind of collapse a decade-long project. I think the emphasis is more the sense of, if you have, or if you are attempting to define a culture and a counterculture in terms of it being a generation of the young, you are immediately placing a limitation on that, because of course that generation is not going to be young for long. It's always going to be limited, it's always going to be narrow in terms of its scope, it's always going to be a very brief flowering. And if you follow a number of the figures who come to prominence into the 1960s, they carry on doing things, they carry on developing their projects. They perhaps don't have the sort of glorious, if not apocalyptic, resonance and significance of some of the language that's highlighted in the 1960s. I'm thinking here about the language pertaining to the Age of Aquarius, for example. There isn't this kind of one kind of singular moment where a kind of golden age apocalyptically is made manifest all of a sudden. But I think the reason why we sort of sometimes see the 1960s as a kind of failed project and kind of doomed to fail, or something which didn't fully realize itself, is because there's kind of enormous amount of emphasis placed upon the work of a relatively small number of people in relation to kind of almost, if you like, fetishizing them as a youth culture. And that's not going to last. That's always going to be extremely temporary. And it's almost as if sort of subsequent historical analysis of those projects can't seem to really get past the idea that, yes, you know, oh my goodness, they do actually grow up and change and start to do different projects.
So then, perhaps we're going a bit, you know, we're going a bit before, well, with this question, I'd be going a bit before the book, so the book's 60s to early 70s.
Yeah.
But what do you think it was about the, you know, the era prior that made everyone in the 60s, you know, perform, you sort of, you know, want to drop out and want to just channel their chaotic side?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one way of looking at that is to say, well, you know, there's a certain exceptionalism linked to the 1960s, in the sense we celebrate this so-called counterculture. But another way of thinking about this is that, you know, that movement, that impetus is not just limited to the decade of the 1960s. Certainly, if you look across the 20th century, you can see repeated iterations of one generation challenging the other in a variety of ways. I mean, you can think about the you know, you can date this from, say, elements of the Fin de Siècle and the kind of the aesthetic movement and the decadent movement. You can move through this in terms of looking at various strands in modernism. And then you can think about, say, beat writers in the 1950s and so on and so forth. So in one sense, the sort of impetus and the cultural drive that we're talking about here has various other examples and instantiations. It isn't just unique to the 1960s. As regards what actually prompted the appearance of that impetus and prompted the its own manifestation in the 1960s, yes, you're right, it does very much precede the decade. And I think the kind of energy and the drive and the commitment that feeds into the manifestation of that kind of countercultural impetus in the 1960s has a lot to do with the end of the Second World War. The end of the Second World War, it ends in a very particular way. It ends with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It ends with this movement into the atomic age, and it ends with a very spectacular demonstration of the fact that human culture, in terms of its scientific and technological expertise, has moved into a zone in which that expertise essentially announces the possible annihilation of life on Earth. That's to say, technological capabilities has sort of exceeded the ability and the sort of mortal reach of those who initially put it into operation. And it's not just an element of sort of battlefield combat with the arrival of nuclear weapons and their testing and their use. It's really changed the kind of the cultural and the social and also the spiritual landscape. So I think that the generation who come of age in the 1960s come of age with a combination of feelings and attitudes, an enormous sense of trepidation about the possibilities and the potentialities of another global conflict, and a sense of its imminence. Okay, but also in addition to that sense of anxiety and fear, there's also a real sense of frustration and a real sense of disillusionment as regards the prior generation who effectively brought that into operation. The sense that, you know, these governments and these parental structures and these kind of family structures, which are sort of a microcosmic reflection of the wider governmental structure, these are the ones who sort of marched into the Second World War. This is what this technological expertise and precision ushered us into. This is what it is has sort of given rise to. That all of these terrible things happened, as it were, on the watch of the prior generation. So certainly if you look at the writing of someone like Jeff Nuttall, who was a writer and artist and a poet, who wrote a very interesting book called Bomb Culture, which was published in 1968. He looks at the countercultural movement of the 1960s and what was called the English underground. And he looks at its poetry and its artistic movements. And he says that, you know, this is the kind of obvious shift and the obvious manifestation, the obvious creative direction to go in for a generation who are growing up in what he calls a post-Hiroshima napalm scorched world, in the sense of the art and the movements are in some ways expressing a kind of revulsion and a disgust and an anxiety towards those events and those potentialities, but also attempting to create a kind of independence, a kind of autonomy, a sort of enclave and a kind of social movement away from the structures, the conventions, and the influence of the prior generation, who seem, from certainly from the perspective of Jeff Nuttall and various associates and fellow travellers, seems to have been pushing the world and pushing politics and pushing global conflicts into very difficult and dangerous directions. So reflecting on that, it's not so much a kind of frustration just against one's parents. It's almost a frustration against the generation that led the world into potential total disaster that does inform a lot of these movements at the time.
So do you think that, I mean, I'm not sure how you define success in this way, but do you think that the 60s was sort of successful in their attempt to break down conservative values in that way?
Well, I mean, you could mark one level of success in the extent of the kind of cultural afterlife that the 1960s have generated. I mean, they've loomed large in the popular and social imagination since the actual end of the decade. They loom large within the sort of nostalgia industry. That's absolutely true. I think the decade occupies a sense of exceptionalism that few of the decades approximate, I think. As to whether what we might refer to the New Left project was successful, one certainly sees at the end of the 1960s, as 1960 becomes 1970, there's a political shift towards the right. There's a definite political shift back, as it were, to conservatism with Richard Nixon in America, Edward Heath in the UK, George Pompidou in France. By the end of the 60s, there's a new wave of political conservatism occupying very much the political landscape of the West. So whilst we can look at the political positions of the 1960s as exemplifying admirable positions, and whilst of course they a lot of those projects and a lot of those positions maintain very interesting, very strong, very necessary movements beyond that, politically the 1960s do represent something of an island within the 20th century. They do represent something of a relatively brief bubble of kind of left-wing activism. So I think that's got to do with the fact that, you know, when we tend to kind of elide the 60s and the counterculture together as if they are exactly the same things. Once you actually begin to think about the details of its history, that which we refer to the counterculture is a relatively small amount of people and a relatively small number of groups within a much wider and a much more complex socio-political landscape, which is largely dominated by a demographic who see the pressures and the political perspectives of the so-called counterculture and the underground as deeply threatening to the status quo. As deeply threatening to a series of values which they hold very dear. And it's certainly from an American perspective, it's the so-called Middle America, the Forgotten Americans, who are seen to be instrumental as putting Nixon into the White House by the end of the 1960s. And thus you get this campaign of law and order, which is very much based around trying to knock back and undo a lot of the social political progressivism that one saw during the 1960s. So the politics of the 1960s and they're highly resonant and they're celebratory and they're very much in line with a lot of left-wing activism that followed. But in terms of the shifts and the movements of mainstream politics, they are somewhat brief and they are somewhat limited. If one was being very harsh and very cynical, one could indeed say, yeah, they kind of failed to flower and fully manifest in the sense of actually changing the mainstream political landscape. So something of a counter argument to that is that, you know, it was also a kind of top-down approach. If you look at the British situation in the 1960s, there was a movement towards a liberal perspective. There was a shift in terms of political policy in a very kind of progressive and left-wing perspective. But that one could say that has less to do with a sort of the effects of political activism. One could say that it has less to do with the effects of successful protests and more to do with there actually being a political will to actually change things. So all those big political movements that one sees from the mid to the late 1960s in the UK regarding censorship, abortion, a legislation regarding the partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, it required there to be a kind of socially progressive mainstream politics in place in order for that to happen. So you have a kind of moment of a reflection of two spheres of interest rather than necessarily a group of people on the street who call for a change and then that change happens.
So what did the, you know, because we often hear about the you know, the hippies, the flower power movement, and you know, I've got this written down here that it comes across in the book that what was going on is you had sort of free love on one side with the hippies, and you had this sort of hateful, chaotic paranoia on the other side with the Manson family. But then I have just noticed now that, you know, the hippies were obviously aligned with the left wing. The Mansons were sort of just this chaotic, nomadic hatred that was, you know, elusive. So what was going on with the right? And do you agree with the idea that in the 60s that you had the hippies and then you had the Mansons as sort of this moral spectrum? You know, you can go one way or the other. You can go free love or you can turn back to the man and just become sort of paranoid and hateful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think in one sense it's very easy to look at those as being extremely polarized groups. And in the various cultural histories of the 1960s, and this is something I kind of wanted to write, sort of review, really, not necessarily write against, but review. But Manson seems to appear as this troubling and traumatic anomaly, as if to say it's all great, it was all going perfectly well, and then Charles Manson turned up and sort of spoiled the entire thing. And I do think you're right in the sense of, yes, they represent polarities on, I think in our correspondence, you were talking about a kind of ethical spectrum. I think that's absolutely right, that you have something of a peace movement, you have anti-war, you have flower power, and then on the other side, you have Charles Manson that is apocalyptic, it's misanthropic, it is chaotic, and so on and so forth. But they're not as far as apart as what one might expect. They're kind of mirror images. And I think the thing we need to keep in mind about Charles Manson is he's sort of older than the generation that we might refer to as stereotypical hippies. Once he actually comes on the scene, he is over the dreaded age of 30. And he arrives in San Francisco straight out of jail. He spent the majority of the 1960s in prison. And Charles Manson is somebody who was in and out of jail pretty much his entire life. But he went to prison in the very early 1960s following a series of parole violations linked to an earlier stage of imprisonment. And that was related to him essentially sex trafficking across America, where he was essentially running in the late 50s, the classic fraudulent talent agencies, something called Three Star Enterprises, where he was meeting people straight off the bus in Hollywood, promising them all kinds of meetings with producers and agents and so on and so forth, and then essentially pressurizing them into prostitution. And that's what he ended up going to jail for in the early 1960s. When he gets out of prison and he goes to San Francisco and he goes to Haight Ashbury, he effectively picks up where he left off, but he's not talking about casting agents and casting calls and meetings with producers. He very quickly starts to adopt the language of the hippies and the embryonic counterculture. But he's still targeting the same group of people. He's targeting lost, vulnerable young women who are seeking some kind of anchorage, and he zeroes in on these people who seem to lack a kind of form of social support, and he very quickly makes himself the key point of anchorage in their life, and he draws this group together. So all of his language, which does speak of of a kind of spiritual seeking. He does talk about himself in a very kind of pseudo-mystical and religious way. He develops a kind of philosophy, and it would thus it's easy to see him as kind of the dark side of the counterculture, as if he's exemplifying all its kind of terrible apocalypticism, or indeed spiraling the project. But I think that's in some ways that's to give him slightly more credit than what he deserves, in the sense of he's still a con man. But he's adopting a different language to achieve the same end, which is a closed unit around which he is able to exert full physical and psychic control. So it's slightly more kind of complex than just a pure binary, in the sense that you've got someone who is very cannily and very exploitative in his ability to tune into a certain discourse and then use it to achieve his own ends. And you know, one could talk further into about the psychodynamics of the family group, but my take on Charles Manson is that he does very much exemplify the kind of William Burroughs type subject, or the kind of position that William Burroughs would often talk about as being someone who, an agent who begins to believe his own cover story. He kind of exemplifies that someone who is in such deep cover that he begins to actually identify that cover image as if as the person himself, and the sort of project takes on its own life. As to your question about where was the right in all of this, well, the political right were there, very much so, purely and simply. There was a sort of big a kind of miasma and a pressure of conservatism, and the sort of the energy and the vibrancy that we see and that we kind of invest and linked to the counterculture of the 1960s. It's not just there in terms of its kind of celebratory, its own kind of internal propulsion, if you like. Its energy, if you like, is prompted and generated by, if you like, the force of its own opposition. That's to say, there was such a kind of atmosphere of conservatism that in order to occupy a counter position, it had to be very energetic, it had to be very visible, it had to be very spectacular. You know, British and American society does not crumble in this time. What we're actually talking about when we're thinking about the counterculture and the underground, we're talking about enclaves within the culture at large. We're talking about relatively small zones. We're talking about relatively small kind of matrices that constellate around venues or events or points of interest or publications, International Times in the UK, and things like the East Village Other and the Oracle on the West Coast, but you know they are points of interest and sort of outposts, if you like, in a wider political and social landscape, which is still very much it still very much exemplifies and still very much kind of makes manifest the generation and the standards and the conventions which are allegedly being blown away at this time.
Mm-hmm. And with Manson, this is something that I'm so glad you included in the book. Manson had these sort of faint connections to this group, the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Now, many of the listeners have asked me time and time again to sort of find a way to do an episode on this church, because they're extremely elusive, extremely interesting, but there's not many people who are really writing about them, so it's quite difficult to find anyone. And there was one book from Farrell House, but I believe the author has passed away. So, you know, why was it you included these people, and why are they actually quite important to the 60s?
The Process Church of the Final Judgment are, as you said, an extremely interesting group, and I think they are very much hardwired into this story. The myth, if you like, is that they are in some way entangled to the Manson family, and they play into this idea that there's a grand conspiracy whereby the Process Church are connected to the Mansons, and they are also connected to various other cult groups, serial killers, and so on and so forth, who then proliferate in the subsequent decades. That whole myth, I found very interesting. That kind of conspiratorial thinking, I found very interesting. The links between the Process Church and Charles Manson are there in a very peripheral way. The Process Church started in the UK They had a branch, a chapter house in Mayfair in London. Then they expanded quite quickly and opened up other chapter houses, particularly in America. When they opened one in San Francisco, was within the High Ashbury sphere. It's highly likely that Charles Manson may have gone to their buildings. He may even have gone to their seminars and their services, as did many other people. This is the thing, that if you are, you know, when there's a lot made in the kind of conspiracy sphere and the kind of conspiratorial mind worldview of intersections and overlaps between these personages who subsequently gain great status, and there's a lot of become very high profile for a variety of reasons. But if you just think about that kind of High Ashbury ecosystem, it's entirely likely that all these people would be moving in and out of each of the sphere of influence. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a grand conspiracy behind them. So there's kind of anecdotal and peripheral links. And the process put out their own magazine, a beautifully designed, often very disturbing series of journals that looked at different themes. The sort of the most infamous one is one that takes the theme of fear, and it's very well put together. The key person here is a person called Timothy Wiley, who has recently passed away, but he was a very kind of proactive member of the group, and he was a former graphic designer. So he was responsible for a lot of the look of the process and a lot of the graphics, which it's beautiful typography, but they also worked very well with putting disturbing images together, lots of film images together, lots of photography together. It's a very well put together kind of montage or collage. In one of their issues, they actually included a statement from Charles Manson, obviously around the time of the Manson trial. It's very well publicized. Lots of this information was available. Manson was corresponding with people to quite a great extent. So one of their magazines and one of their publications does include a relatively short statement / text from Charles Manson. But again, that doesn't necessarily equate to a grand conspiracy and a point of linkage between the Process Church and the family group themselves. As to what the process were about, this is what, more so than the possible conspiratorial links, it wasn't really that interested me in why I put them in the book. The reason why I wanted to put them in is because they do exemplify, they demonstrate this shift away from, as we said at the start of this conversation, the parental stem. They do very much exemplify a group of searching, seeking, young, highly educated, in some way very ambitious, but also disillusioned group of people who are coming of age at a time where they've sort of lost faith with and lost respect for the preceding generations and their establishments. They're also coming of age in a London which is still... There's visible bomb damage throughout the city. National Service is still there. Rationing is a very recent memory. So they come of age within a period of time where there's a real sense of need for a new direction and a new sense of difference. So the Process Church kind of absorbs all of this and takes these frustrations and this kind of existential angst and spiritualizes it. So they begin to talk quite explicitly about apocalyptic ideas. They do begin to talk about quite explicitly about Christ and Satan uniting in harmony at the end, broadly understood, and you know, Christ will pass the judgment and Satan will carry out that judgment. So their kind of religious language is deeply apocalyptic. It speaks about the end of the world. In terms of their own practice and their kind of attempt to increase the flock, the way that they would make their argument to people they were trying to get into the group, they would say that it's their job to kind of inaugurate this apocalypse, to kind of amplify and to bring the end of the world closer, not purely and simply out of a kind of destructive intent, not purely and simply out of a kind of nihilism, a sort of misanthropy. What lies beneath the language is this idea to unify opposites. Once we actually get beyond the sort of quite startling and quite starkly apocalyptic nature of their language, one finds something similar to and quite comparable to what we might find in things like the so-called Age of Aquarius, various Aquarian beliefs, that sense of society and the planet as a whole, if not the sort of human race, is due some kind of great change. With all these kind of warring forces within the individual, there is a need to bring them into some kind of unity, and that unification will be of such kind of significance and such kind of seismic potential that it will in effect be the end of the world. That's to say, the end of the world as we currently know it, and the world that we currently know it from their perspective was not fit for purpose. It was falling to pieces. It was not fit for purpose. It was not doing its job. It was not looking after, and it was not conducive to the health of the human individual. The process I find that I am also very interested in them, not just because of the kind of the sort of shop front worldview, but they also emerge out of another sort of set of influences and another kind of cultish type of behavior, broadly understood, in the sense of they're effectively a splinter group from Dianetics. They are effectively a splinter group from the ideas that constellate around L. Ron Hubbard, and Dianetics obviously later became the Church of Scientology. The process were put into operation by Robert de Grimston and Marianne McLean, who, before they branded themselves as the process, offered a kind of renegade Dianetics under the name of compulsions analysis. And it was a sort of combination of psychoanalysis and systems theory and Scientology, sort of designed to work through people's neuroses, to articulate their neuroses, to sort of expel them. And what one finds with the process is sort of taking all those ideas which are somewhat subliminal within Dianetics, that Dianetics being almost a combination of sort of popular electronics and medieval demonology with the e-meter and the reactive mind and so on and so forth, and taking it in a much more kind of spiritual and para-religious direction, offering it less in terms of a kind of self-help or therapeutic process, but offering it much more in the sense of this closed, hermetic, in some ways quite sinister is the wrong word, I say probably kind of extreme religious lifestyle, which comes complete with a very particular look, a very particular set of language, and also a very particular set of graphics. In addition to the very well-designed magazines, they're also known for their cloaks, their kind of purple line cloaks, their long hair, their beards. And I think this was a very carefully crafted look. And this is also something that influences me, interests me, not just about the process, but about a lot of these kind of groups in the 1960s, that there's a very knowing cultivation of a sort of public persona. The members of the process, it's as if they've stepped out of some kind of comic book. It's as if they've stepped out of a Dennis Wheatley novel. It's as if they've stepped out of some kind of Hammer horror film. That these kind of, their look is this it's kind of part hippie, but it's also something of a slightly decadent occultist aristocrat look. And I think that they actually worked quite hard to promote that kind of particular kind of semiotics, and that self-consciousness I find very interesting. The group as a whole has a relatively short life, but very momentous and very kind of event-filled. And they left London, they moved around America, and they had a very kind of extreme experience in where they kind of survived a hurricane, and that seemed to convince them that they were God's chosen group. And that gave them a renewed sense of commitment and a renewed sense of drive. And they came back to London sort of impassioned, both in terms of their exceptionalness, but also in terms of the commitment to this mission, which was a kind of a semi-apocalyptic mission where they were thinking about trying to unify these warring points of opposition within the individual.
What's interesting there is that it seems, you know, a lot of what's going on in the 60s, what's going on with the Process Church, what's going on with Manson, this idea of like deconstructing your previous sort of conservative ego. And it seems that the mistake
that a lot of people made in the 60s, and where the darkness comes in is that people don't seem to realize that at the moment when you're completely sort of vulnerable and destroying every, should we say, like Oedipal or familial thing that you have, that's when someone can come in. And there's a lot of these groups around. Like Matt, that's what Manson did. He preyed on people's vulnerability. Process Church are doing. That's what Scientology did. It's like, we're going to deprogram you first, and then people seem to forget that, well, if you're deprogrammed, all your the next thing that comes along isn't the truth. It's just a new reprogramming, right? So do you think the darkness in the 60s is actually this sort of is sort of flower power, but it's covertly actually a form of control in the same way that any sort of like conservative way is a form of control? These people were just using the vulnerability. You know, people are vulnerable once they've been deconstructed, and many, most of these groups, perhaps the 60s itself in a certain way, is using this vulnerability to then attune these people to whatever whims or whatever aims that that group wanted, really.
That you're absolutely right. That's an extremely good way of putting it. I think you've hit the nail on the head there, particularly use of the word deconstruct. I don't think there's any coincidence that a lot of these ideas from post-structuralism are being developed at the same time. If we think about deconstruction, and if we think about it in terms of the intellectual method from Derrida, you know, he's offering his Structure, Sign and Play essay in 1966. Similar work is coming from Roland Barthes during this time, and Michel Foucault, obviously, as we've mentioned before, Deleuze and Guattari are generating their ideas at this time. I don't think that's any surprise, because it's almost as if the concepts of the I, concepts of identity, are not necessarily being changed in this period. We often might want to draw upon phrases like alternative to think about an alternative culture. And there's obviously that idea is there within the concept of a counterculture. But I think once we get down to it and we're thinking about what was actually taking place and what was being offered, I think, yes, you're right to talk about it in terms of a deconstruction of the self, a deconstruction of the ego, in the sense of all of those prevailing kind of holding ideas, points of reference, are being shown to be provisional. The contingency is being highlighted, the sort of non-sustainable kind of metaphysical position is being highlighted. They're shown to be always in a position of deconstructing themselves. I think that's absolutely true in terms of a lot of the discourse, a lot of the kind of interrogation that one sees across the spectrum. Within that, however, yes, you're also right that does open out a space for exploitation. It renders individuals very vulnerable. We're not just talking about a mode of textual critique here. We are talking about a way in which communities were being operated, micro communities were operating. And that's absolutely the way in which Charles Manson would work. He would remain in control throughout the various activities that he would put the family through. He would maintain the kind of anchorage position. He would be the person who could then reduce someone's defenses, reduce someone's sense of self, and then quite simply step into it. So yes, it was that mode of thinking that did open up a space for an enormous amount of exploitation. I think on the other side, one could also say that in different areas and different capacities, the deconstruction was not played out far enough. That's to say that, you know, you do have when we think through what was going on in High Tashbury, when we think about what was going on in the London underground scene at the same time, the mid to late 1960s, there is this language of progressivism, there is this language of a kind of left-wing activism, there is this desire, broadly speaking, not to be like our parents, so-called. And what's also carried within that is this idea of seemingly quite defined gender roles. But at the same time, the counterculture was incredibly patriarchal. At the same time, that, you know, what was being promoted in terms of the overall discourse was often not put into practice in the way in which those communities and the way in which those enclaves operated. They were very traditional in terms of their gender boundaries. So, you know, these these structures, these hierarchies, these kind of forms of intellectual scaffold were still very much there and still very much problematic within the underground, within the counterculture. And it was almost as if there was a failure to sort of realize that, or indeed an unwillingness to actually think through this. I think a very good example of that is Jenny Fabian's book, Groupie, where she describes the kind of lifestyle of someone moving from one rock band to another. And on one level, the novel is this kind of celebration of a certain kind of hedonism. It's a celebration of a certain kind of sexual exploration. It's a celebration of a certain kind of sexual independence. But at the same time, Jenny Fabian is quite concerned to point out that each time her female figure moves from one band member to another, one group to another, she essentially occupies the same role. She becomes the kind of wife, secretary, mother, a facilitator to all these male figures. The sexual and the gender roles remain very traditional, despite this wider talk, despite this these wider forms of behaviour of changing all those hierarchies.
So, do you think a lot of this liberation then, this sort of emancipatory, these emancipatory acts, this, you know, libertine, decadent way of being, do you think a lot of it ended up then for its own sake, and it was actually a bit surface level?
Well, I think yes, I think you could perhaps say that. I don't think it's necessarily entirely for its own sake. I think there's a politics there. I mean, I think if you look at, say, things like you know, the kind of examples that are usually trotted out to exemplify a certain kind of atmosphere or a certain kind of ambience of the 1960s. We do have these things like Flower Power. We do have these, we do go back to the Beatles and All You Need Is Love. We do think about the Summer of Love. We and all these other kind of examples that are connecting the 1960s with this idea of love. And it's very easy and it's very tempting. And it's very kind of straightforward to say, well, look, that was just a kind of call to a kind of unreconstructed hedonism. It's a kind of the emancipatory politics of the 1960s were simply a way of a kind of avoidant method of privileging one's own pleasure. It's ultimately very selfish, and then obviously it doesn't lead anywhere. And thus it takes place within the subsequent popular imagination as this kind of dream world, as the scene that we might want to conjure or nostalgically remember when we want to experience a certain kind of vicarious pleasure away from it all. Like we might be fed up with our jobs, and thus we might want to think about kind of naked hippies running through a field, and thus it represents a kind of a kind of beautifully pleasurable kind of a Elysian feel. I think that's a slightly too simple way of seeing it, because I think if you look at that language of love, there is a real kind of political impetus to it. There's a call for a certain mode of behaviour. When we think about the Summer of Love, it is a phrase that has a certain kind of, it took on a kind of a certain kind of meaning within the popular repertoire of the time. It became a kind of tabloid phrase, if you like, but it is a phrase that came out of the Haight-Ashbury experiment. Its kind of full context is the Committee for the Summer of Love, in that when Haight-Ashbury was trying to develop itself as this autonomous, as this self-supporting community, they were aware that because of the range of publicity and the range of exposure the community was getting, they were aware that the approaching summer of 1967, they were going to experience an enormous influx of people trying to experience the area, move to the area. There would be students, tourists, runaways, people from coming to this relatively very small area from across the country. Now, Haight-Ashbury is basically a couple of streets in San Francisco. They're aware that they didn't really have the sort of community leaders who circulated around a group called the Diggers, were very conscious of the fact that they were going to have this enormous swelling of their population without the proper infrastructure to actually support it. So if the community was going to actually continue, if it was going to maintain itself as an actual kind of functioning autonomous community, they needed to work in harmoniously. They needed to work as a functioning cooperative. So the language of love was there to signify a kind of, we must regard people in this community as if they are our loved ones. We have to regard everyone as our brother and sister. We have to share our resources without expecting anything back. We have to be committed to the welfare of the person next to us, because otherwise this community is going to fail. So it's not just this call to do whatever you like, have sex with whoever you want without any consequences. It's that sense of there does need to be, to make this thing work, it has to be a group effort, which proceeds on from a duty of care. And when we think about the sort of analog to that, when we think about the Beatles and we think about their broadcasts of "All You Need Is Love," again, it's easy to be sort of slightly cynical about that in terms of its sentimentality. Similarly, kind of cynical about images of people putting flowers in guns. But you know, the call, the use of that word "love" at that time is a and when we think about the kind of the vociferousness of that call and the kind of commitment that's behind it, and the volume which informed it, it's an index of the extent to which the world was seen to sorely lack it at the time. This is a world which is in a kind of global state of warfare. This is a world in which there seems to be a distinct lack of care between members of the human species, where there's not just a lack of care, but a kind of overt sort of malevolence between members of the human species and the human group. So that word love does have this sort of political impetus to it. There is a kind of a call for and a drive towards respect and reverence and care for each other and a desire to work together in some kind of community. Whether or not you feel that actually works or that's got anywhere, I mean, obviously that's a slightly different argument, but I guess the point I'm trying to make at this stage is a lot of the language that it is easy to see it as a kind of an invitation to unthought, an invitation to a kind of selfish pleasure. But there was a kind of theory and also a practice underpinning that.
Okay. So do you think there's anything key that I've missed or that you'd like to add in that's unique to the book? Anything you'd like to add in?
Well, I guess the overall idea is that one thing I was trying to get at is the way in which 1969 specifically is often seen as this disastrous year. The fact that the decade plots a trajectory from some kind of optimism, a certain degree of hope, and then there's a series of events which take place in the late 1960s, which seems to spoil all of that. We've talked about Charles Manson quite a bit, but I guess the other event just to mention here is the Rolling Stones concert at the Altamont Speedway in December 1969. This is another one of these events in which is often spoken about as if it signals a death knell for the 1960s. And yes, it was a terrible event. Yes, of course, deny the fact that was a terrible event in which there was a terrible loss of life, which was a terribly badly organized event. And it's inevitable that things didn't go the way that the group had actually planned. But I think what's also very interesting about that event is the way in which it kind of subsequently then looms large within the popular imagination regarding the 1960s. And there are factors linked to that event which are not just due to the fact that it was badly organized and it went horribly wrong. The event brings together lots of ideas and symbols and images which were percolating elsewhere in the decade. The Rolling Stones were working through this kind of Luciferian persona. A lot of the songs they performed at the actual concert carried with them these images. Mick Jagger was there with a kind of Omega sign emblazoned on his chest. The Hells Angels were there. It seemed to take place in a kind of apocalyptic landscape. It takes place towards the end of 1969, in December 1969. It takes place, you know, shortly after the Manson murders. There's a number of other kind of parallel incidents and sensibilities at the time. So I guess what was actually interesting me about Altamont is not just the events, although I do go to some degree and into some detail to highlight the fact that they were indeed terrible and tragic. But I guess what interests me, which is also what interests me about Charles Manson and to a slightly lesser degree the Process Church, is that they bring together lots of different symbols. They bring together a very potent and resonant language, and they seem to be kind of nodal points within the history of the 1960s, in which lots of things begin to overlap, which are already there within the decade and within its culture. And it's because they're so kind of thus overloaded and overdetermined that they take on a life of their own, that Altamont ceases to name a kind of place or an event, but it seems to be almost this talismanic magic word that sort of sums up the end of the 60s, not the conclusion of the 1960s, but somehow the end of the 60s as a broader social and cultural project. So I suppose just as a kind of nod towards what I'm actually talking about in the book, is a lot I'm trying to get at what it is that causes a singular event to take on this kind of cult status, to take on this kind of symbolic resonance that far exceeds itself. And I think Altamont is a very good test case as to that kind of incident and that kind of cultural matrix.
Okay. So whereabouts is the best place to purchase the book? I'll put links in the description, but to help you out, would it be best to get it from the publisher?
Yeah, if you get it straight from, it's published by Icon Books, and it's published last year by Icon Books. And if you go to their website, you can order it from them directly, and they've got all kinds of links on there to the book depository, book hive, etc., etc. But it's the best to order from them direct.
Okay. I think we could go on for hours and hours, because there's so many. The book is absolutely filled, jam-packed with 60s and early 70s sort of ephemera and cultural ongoings and little things you've never heard of. But I think we've covered a good chunk of it. So James Riley, thanks very much for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me.